This week, Emil Nadi, Bob Arnold, and Lydia Hayes of Alaska Native Foundation discussed the production of the Native Claims textbook. I'm Mo Wasley, and welcome to Potlatch. Emil Nadi, who's the president of Alaska Native Foundation, gave us some background on their new textbook.
About 2 years ago, the Parent Advisory Committee that works with state-operated schools had some money that they wanted to put into a project to provide information to Native students about land claims. State-operated schools approached the Alaska Native Foundation to see if we were interested. We wrote up a proposal and submitted it to the then state-operated schools, and the board of directors accepted the proposal. We had a very short time to write the book and frantically looked around for a project director. We were fortunate to find Bob Arnold, who was formerly with the Federal Field Committee, to take on the project. We've been in process of writing the book for probably a year and a half, and the book is finished. It's a hardbound book. The state-operated schools and the Parent Advisory Committee wanted a book that had dignity. They wanted a book that was hardbound. The book is hardbound, has a nice cover, has high-quality paper, has a lot of pictures, and about 22 four-color maps, and it's a book that will stand with any book in the library. We have supplemented the money that was provided by state-operated schools, as well as the Anchorage Borough School District under the Indian Education Program. They have some money into the project. So it's been a three-way effort to produce the book that's now available. I would guess it's in the neighborhood of probably $160,000 just to develop materials. Once it's in circulation, I think we ought to really make an effort to get it into the curriculum for every student in the state, because everyone living in Alaska is affected by land claims, and the schools coming out of high school, I mean the students coming out of high school, regardless of who they are going to be affected if they live in Alaska, and they should understand the basis and some of the elements of the land claims. And this book will provide the background information and the elements in land claims that I feel is necessary. I think it will lessen friction between Native people and other people. The experience that we had field testing it indicates that people start talking about some of the things that are on their minds and causing them to be separated. And I think as long as people can talk about it, those frictions will disappear.
That was Emil Nadi. Bob Arnold, former director of the Alaska Educational Broadcasting Commission, tells of the concept of the book and how it is different from other books in the school system.
One thing that makes it unique is that it is the destinies of Alaska Natives that are the focus of attention for our authors. At first glance, this then it does make it different from other books, and at first glance it may appear to be biased or slanted in some way, but I think those who would make that claim are people who don't understand history and in the written sense, because all history is interpretive and one must choose the subject of attention and then follow that through. What we have written in the section on American Indians is correct, historically accurate. What we have condensed into 5 chapters of a unit might be scattered throughout a 700 or 800 page book, because the authors of that other book were focusing upon the cowboy or the railroad, or the corporation which wanted land. Similarly, in our section on Alaskan natives and their lands, what we try to show is that over the years from the time of the Treaty of Cession to statehood, that Alaska natives were unable to obtain land except under terms unsuitable to their circumstance. For instance, there was that famous 1915 meeting of Athabascan chiefs of the interior with Judge Delegate Wickersham, and he said, well, they were worried about the railroad that was coming through and more white men coming into the country. And they said, they asked of him, what can we do about it? And he said, well, you could get a townsite lot because that law exists. And the chief said, no, that won't work for our circumstance. We range far and wide. And he said, well, perhaps you could have a reservation. Well, what they had heard about reservations from the lower 48 made them unwilling to follow that course. And also it would be smaller than the area that they and their people used for the harvesting of resources, pursuit of game. What the chief said is, what we want is to have the white men go away and let us live on this land as we always have. And Delegate Wickersham said, no, that wasn't possible. We tell the story somewhat differently from another writer because our focus is to build to this climax of when the pipeline developments with the increasing white population in Alaska. Then it became desperate that land title be obtained, land formal title. But I think careful observers and readers of history will not take issue. They will understand whose destinies are the subject of attention here.
Being at war with each other.
Barbara Streisand. Bob described how he assembled a book, what resources he used, and what the textbook contains.
We decided that half the book would devote itself to how there came to be a Claims Settlement Act, and then the second half explaining what the act is. So the book is different, certainly, from other books. Its climax comes at the end. The climax, in the sense of in this book, is at the middle of the book, with the achievement of the Settlement Act in 1971. The following unit then tries to summarize what the Claims Settlement Act is in a very much abbreviated way, all of which is elaborated upon in the following chapters. Because the act is very abstract and we're talking about upper secondary school users and general readers, we try to make the provisions of the act concrete by reference to what corporations have done by way of implementation through 1975. For the act talks about 7 to 12 regional corporations. We don't really care about that. 12 regional corporations were created. A 13th is now being created. So it becomes more concrete. Similarly, propositions like prior rights and navigability of waters and overselection, we try to make more real by reference to villages and what they chose. And we couldn't show what all 203 village corporations chose, but instead we selected 8, which help illustrate these ideas. These things that affected the selections by villages. We had 10 collaborating writers who prepared drafts on the topics that we jointly worked out. And then I took a look at the draft to see, as an outside reader, what is missing, where is clarification needed. I sometimes added material, I sometimes took material out. I also sometimes moved some ideas from one chapter to another. Then I produced a working draft for the text. We knew that the text needed to be pretty much self-contained, that the resources in the library of most schools, particularly in villages, would be awfully limited. Now, at the same time, because we conceived of the text as meeting this instructional use, we thought in terms of educational objectives. And briefly told, educational objectives are statements of what will be true of a learner at the end of a semester, at the end of a week, or at the end of a chapter, end of a unit. So that together we would develop statements which would be descriptive of what the learner would know at the end of chapter one. Maybe I can make this less abstract by saying, in the case of chapter one, we tell the student in the workbook, when you have finished this chapter, you will know about how long the ancestors of Alaska Natives have been in Alaska, how they probably got here, how they relate to American Indians, and what this has to do with Alaska Native land claims. So the student's attention is focused on these kinds of outcomes. Altogether, we have in the text 139 defined objectives. Readers will learn more than these 139 things. From a variety of sources, we obtained the pictures. Our greatest debt, I think, is to the Tundra Times. Howard Rock, who is one of our collaborating writers, kindly opened his file cupboard and lent us, he must be responsible for at least half the pictures in the book. We also obtained them from the State Museum and the University Archives, from individuals who came in, who were around in the case of the 1960s. Bruce Bedard, who was with the Native Foundation until last year, had personal snapshots taken when Charlie Edwardson and others picketed the oil lease sale in 1969. We were delighted to have those, didn't turn them up in any other collection. Then we obtained pictures from the Bureau of Indian Affairs in Washington and from the Smithsonian Institution and the High Foundation in New York, obtaining permission and paying a fee for each one that we used. A number of individuals were kind enough to lend photographs to us, and at no cost, Frank Flavin, Cord Rusenrung. I guess the list would be too long to give. I should mention one other thing, speaking of pictures, and that's the matter of maps. That turned out to be quite a project. We wanted maps to portray each region, its boundaries, villages, principal streams. We wanted maps to illustrate village selections, then we wanted a large map in the back. And we found that map sources were sometimes in error, U.S. government maps. So we double-checked, and through the cooperation of regional corporations, we believe that we have correct maps region by region, and similarly with the villages, and similarly with the large map, which goes in the folding back pocket.
Looking at the dawn, sailing out from Juneau, far across the Gulf of Alaska. And it's all right. Up Coquillic Way, on by the sleeping lady, Anchorage lights are calling me. It's all right. I got the bloodline in my veins. Yeah, I got to go back there again. Looking at the sun upon McKinley Mountain, this old railway taking me where I'm bound, and I'm okay. Well, I'll be living hard, working on the pipeline, blowing gold can change a man's soul to stone, but not I got the bloodline in my veins, yeah. I got to go back there again. Her down in Palma some years ago. Is she still there? Well, I'm not looking back, 'cause looking back is crazy. Far ahead, someone keeps on calling me, and I know. I got the bloodline in my veins, yeah. I got to go back there again. Well, hear me cry out, hear me shout, sing my song. I'm touching my dreams, my hopes to belong.
That was Joe and Bing. Bob Arnold continues on to tell us about how he arrived at the design for the cover of the book.
We'd been troubled from the beginning that because our focus was specific, land claims, land and how American Indians lost their land, land and how Alaska Natives nearly lost the land, that there was little opportunity to take up matters of culture, Yupik, Inupiat, Tlingit, Haida, various Athabascan groups. They're very lightly sketched. This is not a culture course. A person becomes introduced to each of the major groups of Alaska. One thing that has always troubled American Indian spokesmen is the stereotype. People talk about Indians as though all Indians were alike. Well, similarly, because of the United Land Claims Movement, the reference most often is to Alaska Natives in the text. So we thought first of obtaining translations of the English language title, Alaska Native Land Claims. I'm the one who settled on the title, and I have to admit that it's a very flat, sort of unexciting sort of thing. as I talked with one or two who provided approximations of translations, it occurred to me, what I should have already known, is that instead of translations, these were really new titles for the book, and titles which I liked many ways better than this sort of flat thing we had. So we knew there wasn't room for 20 titles on the cover, so we drew upon Mike Krause's work to know the use of the languages today, about how many people use them, and we sought by long-distance calls and some travel to obtain these retitlings of the book. And we wanted them to be retitlings of the book, but also to constitute a design. And I think the effort was worthwhile. I think it's a heck of a nice cover. And I think the reader who looks to page 3 for the translations of these 10 languages plus English will have his understanding of the land claims enhanced. For instance, one that I can't read the languages, but I can say the English. We regain the Tanina land, the status of the payment for our lands, the acquisition by Alaska Natives of their own lands. And I would hope that most classrooms would spend a day or two talking about those various titles for the book, and then perhaps toward the end of the term, see which one is really the best title.
Bob Arnold, the producer of the Native Claims textbook. In our final segment, Lydia Hayes told of her involvement in developing additional materials for the book.
Several months after the beginning of the textbook project, I was hired by the foundation to develop a teacher's guide and a student workbook that would accompany the textbook. This is a very necessary part of the whole thinking process about the textbook, because in the teacher's guide and workbook would be listed the learning goals and the objectives applicable in the classroom. So Bob and I had to work very closely in working out what would be the best approach to take on determining objectives. Based on those objectives, then I was to develop suggestions for the teacher's guide as to what kinds of learning experiences would be good for students in the classroom. Also, at the same time, I was to develop the student workbook and provide various kinds of review experiences, questions that students could think about that would be directly related to the contents in that particular chapter in the textbook. The teacher's guide is designed so that the teacher can serve as a guide, if you will, to assist students in broadening their understanding about the contents in the textbook, but also to bridge the classroom into the community so that students can learn more about what's going on in their own community in relationship to the land claims settlement, and also so that, the community too can benefit by what's being learned in the classroom. So many suggestions are for the class to go to those resources that are available in the community to visit. For example, if in Tetlin the students know something about their local corporation, they can go visit the corporation and talk with people there, and then the corporate directors can explain to students, you know, how the corporation works. We attempted throughout the project to identify some of the films that are available, some of the video cassettes that are available, some of the audio cassettes that are available pertaining to the land claims settlement. These are, again, very limited resources, but nevertheless, they are listed in the teacher's guide, and they indicate where these can be obtained. Also, there are suggestions for simulation games that are in there, too, that would be useful in the classroom to expand upon some of the concepts that are covered in each of the chapters of the textbook. So the workbook and the teacher's guide are both, I think, springboards to new ideas that might be sparked in each of the communities.
I pity the poor immigrant who wishes he would have stayed home, who uses all his power to do evil, and in the end is always left so.
Pity the Poor Immigrant with Joan Baez. Thank you for listening. I'm Mo Wasley.
Potlatch is produced by KUAC under Title I of the Higher Education Act.